There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to The Mentor. I'm Mark Boris. Simon Molnar, welcome to The Mentor, mate.
Thanks for having me.
And you are the founder and I guess CEO, or what's your title at the
CEO.
Flagship? At Flagship.
Yeah.
So Flagship, we'll talk about in a second. Probably, you know, I like to dig in a little bit. Sydney boy.
Yep.
Always born, bred, raised in Sydney.
Yeah, I feel like when you're born in Sydney, especially in the eastern suburbs, you don't venture too far away.
Eastern suburbs of Sydney, that's we're starting to build a profile now. Yeah. Where'd you go to school?
Moriah College.
Went to Moriah. So Moriah boy, eastern suburbs. You know, there's people will start, he's privileged or whatever, you know, like elitism. What's the deal, mum and dad?
You know what? I would say that I've had a privileged upbringing, but my parents had far from a privileged upbringing. So
let's have a look at that. Talk about that.
Yeah. So my grandparents on both sides are migrants. And
from which part of the world?
My dad's parents from Hungary, fleeing the war, and mum's from Egypt.
Is your mum Egyptian?
Egyptian.
Wow.
Yeah. Quite a unique combination there. And both my parents grew up with not a lot. Mum grew up in the Shire. Dad grew up with a single mum. And both of them really kind of made sure that they gave both Nick and I the life that they didn't have.
Yeah.
So 100% I believe that I had a kind of privileged upbringing, but it was wholeheartedly, I mean, my parents didn't have it easy. They worked really hard to give us that lifestyle. And Nick and I were able to kind of build and grow on it.
Molnar doesn't sound very Hungarian to me.
It's very Hungarian.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's Hungarians will see the surname and straight away they know we're Hungarian. It's the equivalent of Miller or Smith.
Oh, really?
Yeah, over there. So. Like
Molnar Miller sounds. Because what's interesting is it's particularly I'm assuming that as a result of your father's family coming from Hungary during the war or around the war period, that they were fleeing the Jewish persecution.
They were.
And mum's not Jewish?
She is.
Mum's Jewish as well?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's pretty unusual in Egypt, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
We have to go back about as far as Moses to find out the Jewish people in Egypt.
Yeah.
Would that be right? Like,
You know what? I probably haven't done as good a job of understanding my grandparents' history as I probably should have.
Yep.
But again, my understanding is that it wasn't easy for them either, being Jews in Egypt.
No, I'd imagine so, because it's not a Jewish nation but in terms of numbers. So my father also came to Australia during the war, and not for because of religious persecution, but because of the Germans occupied his village in Greece. But they tend to come to Australia and they have their kids and their kids have their kids, in this case you, and everybody's – a lot of pressure on everybody to go to university and do something at university. And generally speaking, they send them to pretty good schools, even if that means, you know, working two or three jobs to get the kids through.
Yep.
And you and Nick obviously got – but did Nick go to Moriah too?
Yeah, he did.
Okay. So Moriah starts off with juniors. I can't remember now.
Yeah, starts from kindergarten.
Yeah, goes through year 12.
Yeah.
Were your parents then saying boys, you leave school and you've got to go off and get a job, but more importantly, you've got to go to university. Did you get the university job?
Yeah. It's funny. My mum kind of reinforced and kind of empowered me, especially, I'm assuming she had the same conversations with Nick, but that we were kind of in charge of our own destiny. Every drive to school should always say, I don't care if you're a garbage man, if that's what you want to be. I just don't want that to be the only option that you have. I got towards the end of high school and kind of already knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a software engineer and I wanted to work in tech. And towards the end of year 12, I felt like school was holding me back. I felt like I needed just to finish and get that piece of paper so I could get on with the rest of my life. And I didn't really see university as the logical next step for me. I wanted to start working. I wanted to get my hands on, and I felt like I could learn a lot more from people on the job than I would from a lecturer in a classroom. I had a conversation with David Shane, and
who's he?
Currently, he's one of the founders of OIF Venture Fund. Prior to that, he was founder of Comtech, and at the time, he was the chairman at a company called Macromatics.
How old were you?
I was 17.
Yep.
A software company that provide a lot of data to QSR restaurants.
What's that?
Like quick service.
Oh, right.
So KFC, Red Rooster, Porto.
Right.
And I was a 17-year-old kid. He gave me my first crack. And as a 17-year-old working at a pretty successful software company was an opportunity that not a lot of people probably would have had at the same stage. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I was working with engineers who all went on to become CTOs at different companies. CTO of Prosper, of Zip, company called RangeMe, One Big Switch. And these were the people that I was working directly one-on-one with that I was learning from as a 17-year-old. And I negotiated with my parents to defer for the first year of university, and they agreed.
Negotiated.
And then,
please let me work.
And then it got to the second year, and I basically turned around to my parents and I said, I've worked my way up in this company. It's been 12 months. I feel like I've got a really good foothold in this business, and I don't want to let that go in exchange for university. So again, we agreed
and
that
did.
So we agreed that I'd do university part-time, and part-time uni isn't just 2 days straight and then 3 days off. It's an hour here, 2 hours there. And I realized that I wasn't really making much progress in either direction. I wasn't doing much from a uni perspective, but also I was slipping away from a professional perspective. Again, negotiated with my parents, and they agreed to let me study by correspondence. So online only, and that way I could continue working and study on the side. And I did that for a couple of years, and then eventually decided that what I was doing professionally far surpassed what I was doing from a university perspective. I was maybe a third of the way through. I'd just been offered a job at KPMG, and not a junior role, but not a crazy senior role. And what I realized was that my experience spoke more volumes than what a piece of paper would. So yes, while my parents did originally have that thought, and my grandparents especially had the thought that you need this piece of paper, I realized increasingly that it wasn't as important as what I thought it was, especially in an environment like tech where it moves so quick. Being on the ground and in the job was so much more important and so much more valuable.
How old are you now? Do you mind saying?
31.
Okay, so you're young, right? So you're one of my son's age. I've got four boys. You're like my youngest son's age. I'm your parents' generation, and I remember my grandparents, same as your mother and father's parents. The emphasis in those days was you had to go out and get a degree.
Yep.
Then you worked. But I think today there are environments, like you said, where not back then, but today there are environments where they'll take you on and they sort of take you, I don't want to say the word apprenticeship, but they take you through the process and you can actually learn on the job.
Yep.
And you learn more, what's more relevant. You don't learn a whole lot of other crap. The university system has a lot of subjects, et cetera, in there, which you will never use in a specialist environment, particularly when it comes to engineering.
Yep.
And particularly when it comes to certain parts of software engineering.
Yep.
So you might do electrical engineer degree, or you might do a computer science degree, but they take you down so many rabbit holes over the 4 years or 3 years, whatever it is, take you down so many rabbit holes that are actually ultimately irrelevant to what you end up doing.
Yeah.
But they, instead of doing, getting you to learn four or five different languages, coding languages, just that's all you need to know, and how their application works, which is the only part of engineering degree that's important to you once you become an engineer.
Yep.
It's better. It's much better. But there were those things weren't available to us. And as a parent, I didn't realize that with my kids. So I pushed my kids, go, you're going to get a degree. and my parents pushed me to do the same for the same reasons. I didn't have any alternatives, but my sons have sort of pointed out to me that the degree was actually pretty useless.
Yeah.
And in fact, I didn't need some. And one of them says, he'll say, I don't need the degree at all to do what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And learn on the job. He learned on the job in a year, no debt,
yep.
Got paid,
yeah.
Goes to university, takes 3 years, builds up a big debt, doesn't get paid, had to go and do some sort of shit kicker job at Woolworths or something. No, he was a pizza delivery guy, you know, with the one at Old South Head Road there.
Millennium.
Yeah. He was a pizza guy.
Like everyone's done it. Yeah.
He used to deliver pizza to, you know, like to my place. And I'm with the fuck, you know, like, yeah, he worked there, okay? And he's your age, same age as you. So, it sort of went backwards. And what do you think about that as a young 31-year-old? What would you say to someone who's in their 20s in exactly the same position as you were in your 20s, thinking about should I go on this course or not?
Yeah, it's a great point. I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of my mates that were going through it at the time as well. I believe that university is really important if you plan or want to go into a career where it requires university
degree.
Doctor,
lawyer.
Correct. Or if you don't know what you want to do and you want to buy yourself some time and you want to try and figure it out. And
that makes sense too.
For industries where it's not as applicable and you learn a lot more on the job, and if you kind of know the direction you want to go, then I believe that chasing the opportunity is more valuable. And I believe that there are more businesses these days that care less and less about that piece of paper than what they did 20 years ago. One of the big things that Dave Shane used to say to me was, I love companies that say applicants need a university degree because it means they can't hire half my staff. So that kind of was instilled in me. The person ultimately is so much more important than the ability, because the ability can be taught and can be acquired, but the person is the person. I think there's always going to be outside noise, outside pressure, especially from prior generations, because that's how things were done.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully the older generations have a bit more of an open mind to the same as my parents did, to let me and let them kind of go in the path that they think is most suitable to them.
So did you work with KPMG then?
No, I turned down the job.
And where did you go?
I was at Macromatics for a little bit longer. And then I decided that I didn't want to be a hardcore software engineer.
But you can just describe what a hardcore software engineer is, by the way.
So basically someone that writes code day in, day out. You get tickets, killer. You write code. And what I realized was that I was never going to be the best software engineer in the world. I liked being able to speak the language and I liked having the knowledge, but I didn't want it to be my day job. And what I was really good at was getting from A to B. I knew where I am, I knew where we need to get to, and I'll work out how to get there.
That means we need to create something. We need to create an outcome for a client. I guess you guys are dealing with clients or customers.
Yep.
We need to create an outcome for the customer. Customer's briefed us in on that outcome. This is what they want. What does the architecture look like? Are we talking about architecture now?
The architecture, less architecture, more the solution, thinking outside the box. What is a solution that someone hasn't thought of to solve this problem? And I would say, so kind of taking a few steps back. So my parents had a jewelry store in Sydney CBD for 35 years. So I was brought up on jewelry and on retail. I used to sell Pandora to my math teacher at a discount, and she would sell to her network of friends. And we just had a little side business going on where we'd meet at Westfield Bondi Junction, exchange product. I guess I was never really the entrepreneurial one. That was always my brother. But he was so entrepreneurial that it kind of forced me to think in ways that I hadn't before. And it was funny, growing up, I always saw these business people in either in reality or on TV, and they were always portrayed as these cutthroat people that would kind of do whatever they need to do in order to get whatever they need done.
Donald Trump.
And I just kept thinking that that's not me. And for a long time, I thought that it wasn't an industry or a space that I could go into because I didn't have it in me to be that kind of person. And then the world shifted, the world changed, and suddenly what I started to see was that these people that were in high roles at successful businesses had more integrity, and it kind of started to mold more towards the what I saw myself as being as a kind of person. So fast forward to after Macromatics, and I previously was selling Pandora on eBay. I'd handed the keys over to my brother. All of the stories out of Afterpay talk about Nick selling Pandora on eBay was actually my eBay business that he took over. But I kind of let that one slide. And he was running that. He decided to bring that into a standalone jewelry website. So I joined him there. It was two of us and a couple other kind of part-timers for the most part. And everything had to be self-taught. I had to teach myself e-com. I had to teach myself fulfillment, warehousing, all of these skills I had to learn from scratch. But again, I knew where I was. I knew where I needed to get to, and I could work out what needed to be done in order to get from A to B. And that's how Nick, like my brother and I, worked really well while we were at ICE together. It was called ICE Jewelry.
ICE.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. He would come to me with a problem. I would come back to him with a solution. We'd kind of confirm that we were happy, and then I'd go off and execute. And we worked like that for a couple of years, and then he had this light bulb moment of Afterpay, and he went off on
funding the purchases.
Yeah, and he went off on that journey. And I was still running ICE, but was also with him at Afterpay in the early days, doing a few bits and pieces. And that same working relationship that we had at ICE continued into Afterpay, where he'd come to me with a problem, we'd ideate a solution, and then I'd go and execute. And then one day I remember we got pulled up, and I think it was the COO at the time said, "I know this is how you guys work, and it's worked really well for you guys up until now, but we've got a structure, we've got a framework that you guys need to work under." So the thing with my brother and I is we've always had a really good working relationship. I've always known what I'm good at. I know what he's good at. He knows what I'm good at and what he's good at. And we're always really good at kind of meeting in the middle and delegating without stepping on each other's toes.
Would you describe it like he cuts you so?
I don't quite understand.
But if we just go back to I'm talking more in terms of a poetic way of describing it, but as an entrepreneur, here we go around cutting the suit, cutting out the piece of cloth. But of course, it looks like the shape of the suit, and he's already chosen the suit material, looks nice and all that sort of stuff. But you have to sew it up. It has to be stitched up all the way through. And someone has, in every good business, there's someone who cuts and there's someone who sews.
Yeah.
I describe my younger brothers as the sewer. I'm the cutter. And entrepreneurs usually considered to be cutters, sewers. Entrepreneurs usually can be cutters, but they always have a bloody good sale behind them.
Yeah.
People like me, I'm not sure about Nick, but cutters are a bit of a mess sometimes.
Yeah.
Either a lawyer or something like to come following you through, make sure there's not too much mess. And in your case, I mean, definitely in the case of what your expertise is IT solutions or infrastructure solutions or solutions around – How do I execute?
I was the executor.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Nick definitely is the cutter. I mean, again, I've had the fortune, obviously he's kind of my big brother. I've looked up to him and taken a lot of what he does so well and kind of tried to apply that a lot to what I do. So while he was the cutter and I would kind of execute, although at Afterpay he had a lot of really great executors around him, including himself, But what I started to learn from him was not only how to sew,
but how to cut.
Exactly.
So you learned the entrepreneurial skill at the same time.
Exactly.
You know, it's very interesting about that, because as an entrepreneur myself, I find it very difficult to be learn how to do the other part, because the other part requires a lot of attention to detail, a lot of patience, and it requires a fair bit of interaction with the team.
Yep.
Because it'll end up being a whole lot of people involved. Whereas my younger brother can also, like you, he's observed my entrepreneurship. He can become that person. He has become that person.
Yep.
It's much more difficult to go back the other direction for, say, Nick or I.
Yeah.
I can execute, but it's sort of requires, there's a lot more subsets to it.
Yep.
And it requires a lot of subset thinking.
Yeah.
And it's a thought process way of thinking, as opposed to if you're the person who's doing the execution like you, and you're thinking about being the person who's going to be the entrepreneur, that's just like dreaming big and thinking big and looking at observing big things.
Yeah.
It's actually more fun. It's
yep.
a bit more enjoyable, and it's yep. easier to do.
So much.
Easier to adapt
yeah.
to be that person. It doesn't mean you're always going to be successful, but it is an easier transition, I think.
Yeah.
Have you found that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess part of coming up with solutions is part of that, I guess, entrepreneurship. Again, it's I'm at A, I want to get to B. How can I get to B? And slowly work my way back and work through it in smaller steps in order to do that. So, I mean, even when when I started working on Flagship, the overall goal for me was bringing more tech into brick and mortar retail.
Well, let's talk about Flagship. Okay, so because you've gone through the Afterpay process, you've had all the stuff that you did before, learn how to code and blah blah blah. So we're at Flagship, okay?
Yeah.
Give me the light bulb moment that you thought what Flagship does is something that society needs.
So towards the end of, I think it was 2020, was when Afterpay had been acquired by Block.
Mm-hmm.
I very quickly realized that no one person had the same level of impact that they once upon a time had. And that was the time for me to start exploring new opportunities. I never wanted to be a small cog in a big machine. That's why I didn't take the KPMG role. I wanted for everything that I do to have a material impact in what I was doing. I started consulting for a brand called Venroy here in Sydney.
Oh, I know the Venroy boys.
Yeah, they're great.
My son is their accountant. Is their CFO.
Right.
Alex, yeah. One of my older boys.
Small world.
Yeah. Sean.
So, yeah. I love Sean. He's great. So I was doing some contract work for them, focusing on their e-com site, and I started asking them questions about their stores so that I could make better e-com decisions. And they couldn't answer any of my questions.
About their physical stores.
About their physical stores. Because all of my digital touch, all of my retail had always been digital. I'm digital native. I read data. I can speak in binary, kind of. But everything for me is very data driven. I always say I never knew the first thing about jewelry. I just knew how to read data to put the right product in front of the right person at the right time. And this was me coming into a world of no data. So the goal for me was essentially, how do I take more of that digital mindset that I've had, and how do I apply that to brick and mortar retail? And again, it was that A to B, test and learn, poke my nose in different places until something sticks. And I landed on something, and it's funny because what I landed on actually is now solution today. The solution I landed on was a company that we'd partnered with out of Israel, and they produced these batteryless Bluetooth stickers.
Bluetooth stickers.
So it's a sticker.
Yeah.
Literally a sticker. You'd stick it onto a swing tag of an item of clothing. We'd have a wireless charger mounted to the roof that was also a receiver. It would charge all of these stickers in the store, and every sticker would send a real-time location back to the receiver.
And that's for stolen goods.
That was one component, but the bigger component was that we were actually able to get real-time location of every item in a store.
Right.
So we were able to tell retailers what's being picked up, what's being tried on, what's converting, what's not converting, how long are people spending in a fitting room. And again, it was all of the analytics and data that I'd had from a digital perspective that I was trying to bring in store.
Right.
And what we realized with that was that hardware is challenging. The macroeconomic climate changed, and the narrative shifted away from growth towards cost savings and efficiencies. And what I realized was selling a retailer on why they should increase their cost base for the long-term reduction in cost base was a very tough sell for a hardware solution that takes a long time to install, long time to see value in, and there were a lot of other complexities associated with it. So we, for all intents and purposes, had to go back to the drawing board and back to square one. And we had an investor partner, or our current investor partner back then, who took one look at our cash flow forecast and basically said, you're going to face an uphill battle with hardware. Go and find a software solution.
And so no runway.
Exactly. So went back to the drawing board, and we literally just spent weeks speaking to retailers.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, I'm back here with Simon Molnar, and we're talking about, he's just taking me through the journey that he realized that hardware is a very hard sell, actually, in terms of capital and the amount of patient capital that is available out there in marketplaces from investors in terms of runways, et cetera, you know, cash runway. So he's decided to go down the software route. But to go down the software route, you've got to build something, and it's got to be something that there's demand for. And you said, Simon, that you went and talked to some retailers. Are you able to mention the names of retailers?
Yeah, I mean, Venroy, yep. Nude Lucy, RM Williams. Again, I can. This kind of comes back to the privilege point, is that I do feel privileged that I've got access to.
How did you get access to them?
Through Afterpay. Okay. Through working at Afterpay, I rub shoulders with a lot of these brands.
Yep. Because Afterpay would have been on their site.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get it.
The thing about the retail industry specifically is that everyone knows everyone. It's a very small world. And everyone moves from brand to brand to brand. So you meet one person, they've worked somewhere, they can open doors. And again, it comes back to the A to B. I know the B, which is the retail I want to get to, and what is my path to open that door?
Okay, you ring up Venroy or whoever it is that you talk to. That's one thing to know them. It's another thing to get them to agree to open up their doors, their data doors. I mean, how do you work that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's just like building the relationship and building that trust that when we do find something, that there is going to be something in here. And once we find it, they're going to reap the benefits of it because they'll get first access.
Okay, so that's what you say. I'm going to give you, like, I'll give you an exclusive 6-month run or something like that.
Yeah, or they kind of shape the product. So, I mean, again, kind of touching on what you mentioned before, I'm a big advocate of I don't know what I don't know.
Yep.
And I can come in with a hypothesis and I can think that something's going to work, but until I actually find out from the source of truth, I don't really know. I was really fortunate that I had a really great product manager with me who knew the right questions to ask. And we would go into these retailer meetings, and one of my strengths is pattern recognition. So Nick always used to go to these investment banking jobs, and you had to do the pattern recognition tests, and I would do those.
What is that?
They would give you like symbols on a sheet, and it would basically say what comes next in the sequence.
Right.
And that's my bread and butter, like solving Rubik's cubes, puzzles, all of that kind of stuff. So when I'm sitting with retailers and I'm having conversations with them, I'm able to kind of identify what the consistencies are across those retailers. So we'd go into one retailer meeting and we'd come out of it, and I'd say to my product manager, hey, for the next meeting, I want you to focus on this.
So you would recognize a pattern.
Exactly.
And then you would narrate that back to your product manager. Just explain what a product manager is. I mean, so you said you had a really good product manager. What are we talking about here? Did you get him out of Canva or something like that?
So we got him out of a company called Stake, the trading platform.
Yep.
And prior to that, he was at BigCommerce, and prior to that, Telstra.
What are the characteristics of a product manager?
I'm essentially the mad scientist that's coming up with all these weird and wacky ideas. And I've got a team of engineers whose responsibility is to build those wacky ideas.
Software ideas, yep. Yeah.
And what I need is I basically need someone that sits between me and them, and also the retailers, who can make sense of what I'm saying, who can prioritize it, and who can make sure that what we're working on actually makes sense and that it's doable, and that we're not working on it's going to take 6 months to build when what we need to build is the thing that's going to take 2 weeks to build.
Right.
So he manages the roadmap, he manages the engineers, he manages myself, he manages retail. He's I mean, for all intents and purposes, kind of the central neurosystem that exists in the business to make sure that every stakeholder gets what they need to get.
He's the decision-making part. He's the prefrontal cortex.
Exactly. Literally.
Driving the amygdala.
Literally.
Like that's you. You're the amygdala.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, we all need those from time to time. Yeah, so that's interesting. So you made sure. So you understand the structure. So, I mean, I guess that comes with your logic, the way your brain works in a logic sense. So you're out there looking at patterns and trying to derive, which by the way is what machine learning does, but you're machine learning through your own brain patterns from the interviews that you're doing or the discussions you're having. Then you're coming up with what might be solutions. You put in a product manager in the middle of it all. He or she then talks to the engineers who build. So they're the building the bit down the bottom, and then hopefully delivering to where you go and then test it.
Correct.
So just, and you've told me that the way you do your part, the machine learning through Simon's brain, you go out and access those networks that, you know, you've been lucky enough to get to meet, or your history has allowed you to meet by virtue of being in Afterpay, et cetera. So that'll make sense. That's leverage. That's good. It's good leverage. And how do you convince, by the way, is there any discussion at any time with the retailers that you manage to talk to? They ever say, what are we going to get out of this?
I mean, they get the value that the product brings.
Yeah, okay.
We built a prototype. We didn't allocate any engineering resources until the prototype was fully ready to go. The retailers were responsible for defining and refining that prototype. So they could see firsthand exactly what their feedback was generating, and they could also see that once we build this, that they're going to have access to this solution that they haven't had access to before.
Right. Tell me the solution. So wrap it into a narrative. What is the solution that Flagship does? Let's pick one, any one of the retailers. Let's pick Venroy, for example. Let's pick their Byron Bay shop.
Yep.
For example.
Yep.
They got one in Byron Bay because I've been in there. I didn't buy anything, but I've been in there.
So essentially we're the central platform that sits between the retailer and their stores.
Yep.
So they've got a store in Byron, they've got a store in Capri, they've got a store in Montauk in New York, and they've got very limited resources in terms of people that are capable of physically going to those stores.
Yep.
But they want to be able to know how do those stores look. They want to make decisions around product placement in those stores.
Is that, and that's what otherwise is referred to usually as merchandising.
Correct.
Yeah.
So normally the way you would do it is you would need to send a person there.
Yep.
That is the only way that you can do it, or you're getting emails or photos back and forth, or jumping on a FaceTime. And it's a process that kind of sits all over the place.
In terms of merchandising, what we're talking about is where the racks are, what's on the racks. Is it close to the cash register or at the front door as you walk in? You know, where is the best places and the highest return places for the most expensive dresser, for example, whatever it is, in terms of how you put them on racks, what do the racks look like, what the spacing looks like.
Correct.
All colors, coding, blah, 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 et cetera. That's what we're talking about. That's merchandising.
Exactly.
So you're right. It's a difficult thing to do, and you, especially when companies are trying to keep numbers of people down because it's a cost thing. So what does your flagship solution do in a, I guess it's a digital solution straight to the store?
Yeah. So every store has a digital representation in the form of a floor plan, and placing products in the store becomes as simple as drag and drop. So a head office can say, this is how I want my store in Italy to work, how I want my store in Italy to look, this is how I want my store in New York to look, and I've got full control of those stores from my office in Paddington.
Yep.
But what we do on the back of all of that is we now have the product placement. So essentially what we were trying to do with the hardware, but without the hardware, that we now know where products are placed throughout a retailer's store. So we can map that through to sales, and we can tell retailers exactly how much revenue is coming from each part of each store.
And can you tell them to change?
Exactly. So we can say you've got 100 stores in your network. One of them is in regional New South Wales that you can only get to once every couple of months because it's not that accessible. And you've got a dress in your front window and it is not performing, but you have a dress that's really deep in your store that no one's actually seeing that is performing well. So we recommend that you take that dress and put it in the front window.
Right. And then they take that recommendation and send it onto the store.
Exactly.
Right.
So
in the regional area.
Exactly.
And they change it around.
Exactly. So visual merchandising for a long time, and even still with the retailers that we're speaking to, it's often a one size fits all. It's a snapshot. It's a moment in time. We're going to change it once a week, once a fortnight, once a month. And there's no data. It just looks pretty. So we'll do it. And what we do is we provide a bit more of the analytics that sits behind it. We quantify it. We tell them how it's performing. And we turn it into a more live solution. So they can make a change at 10 o'clock in the morning and then a different change at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
So it's dynamic. Are you prompting them, or are they dipping in when they need to? How's it work?
So at the moment, I mean, we're still early enough that they're just dipping in when they need to. But the long-term plan is to be proactive. We feed through the recommendations. Exactly.
So, you know, like I'll get an email or whatever. However you notify me. Is it app-based?
It's web-based at the moment.
Web-based at the moment. So I'm going to get an email and it's going to come to me. It's going to say, and I own a shop in Byron Bay, just to pick on a place. And it says that those shorts, because it's summer, those linen shorts that the girls are wearing that have been, they're currently sitting at the back behind the cash register, which no one can get to or feel a bit intimidated to walk around to get to. They should be somewhere else close to the change room.
Yeah.
Because they sell better.
Correct.
Right. And you should do that today. And by the way, you do it today and a couple of days later, you know, maybe it's not in quite the right place. Do you get to the data as to what is selling? I mean,
exactly.
You're getting access to that information as well.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. So we're able to actually see what the impact is of that adjustment.
Wow.
Exactly.
In terms of attracting investors, do you have to build IP protection?
Software is very hard to protect. I mean, again, even with Afterpay, you kind of see how many people, it doesn't matter if you're the first mover, people are going to come and copy.
Yeah. It's always been the best first mover.
Exactly.
If you weren't.
Exactly. So first mover advantage for me is more important than IP protection. And building those relationships and doing things right is also more important for me than IP protection.
That's IP in some respects anyway.
Exactly.
But it's personal IP.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, unfortunately, I mean, there's not much to be done from an actual IP perspective.
So when it comes to talking to investors, because you've got to raise money for these things, because there's a bit of a long tail on it, a bit of patient capital is required, because, you know, it's better than a hardware build, but software build still takes time, testing, new iterations, iteration after iteration, et cetera. You know, so how did you go about talking to investors, and were they ever worried about IP at any stage or non-protection of IP? Is it a question?
I mean, it was raised. It was raised more with the hardware than with the software, right? Because we didn't own the hardware. With the software, there's a lot, especially with what we're doing, there's so many little nuances in what we're building that if you don't nail it, it won't work.
Yep.
And there have been other providers that have tried to tackle similar things and then fallen flat because, I mean, for a lot of them, again, they didn't listen to the retailers. And visual merchandising is the starting point for us, but the plan is to move beyond visual merchandising and go just from in-store visual merchandising to omni-channel visual merchandising, and then from omni-channel merchandising to into marketing, and move, bring in, incorporate e-com into it, and incorporate the buyer into it and the planner. And there's this
buyer being the buyer of what? You mean buyer of what they stock?
Exactly. Yeah. So deciding how many units they purchase.
So it's going to be like nearly a complete inventory from placement to what I hold, what I carry when I get it ready for my, seasons, etc.
Exactly. That's the goal. The goal is to be to the retail industry what Atlassian is to the engineering world.
Right.
Or what Canva is to the design world.
Yeah, yeah.
This platform that everyone, that any retailer needs to use, because whatever function of retail they sit in, we have the solution for them.
And as soon as you, let's say I'm an investor, as soon as you say Canva to design and Atlassian to engineering, my ears prick up. So, because you're talking about retail, but it doesn't matter. Retail needs just as much help as everybody else, but none of those other two, Atlassian or Canva, will actually help the retailer in terms of how they run the shop, how they merchandise the shop. Those two phrases, that's not something you just invented now, I would imagine. How important is it in terms of talking to investors, is it to be able to simply describe what you do? Because that's the most simple and clear description in those two phrases than we spent over the last 40 minutes talking about. Like, how important is that?
It's definitely important.
To an investor, I'm talking about.
Yeah. When speaking to an investor, I want to be able to show the bigger picture vision and where this can go and where we want this to go. But at the same time, you don't want it to be so big and ambitious that it's not actually achievable.
Yeah, yeah.
So honestly, with pretty much all the investors I've spoken to, I've actually taken them on the same journey that I took you on here, where I start small and then take you through to the bigger picture opportunity, because then you can actually see, if I start with, I want to be the Atlassian, I want to be to retail what Atlassian is to engineers, you're going to say, okay, that's some big, hairy, audacious goal, but is it actually achievable? And only by starting at the start again, by coming back to where we are and taking on this journey of how to get from A to B, is it actually possible to show any investor that it's actually achievable?
That pattern of behavior of investors, something that you've observed in the past in terms of the build-up that ends up in leading to a successful outcome for you, someone who might be seeking an investment. So have you observed, did you observe that in the Afterpay days, for example, that maybe your brother did it or Anthony did it, taking investors through this process in a very, small bits, build, instead of walking and say, I'm going to build the solution for retailers similar to the way Afterpay did and Atlassian did, because that's an important point a lot of people like to know, that a lot of people don't know.
Yeah.
How hard do you go into these things? And is that something you observed?
Yeah, it's the way I approached investor meetings is the same way I approach my retailer meetings, and it's the same. It's the way I would approach building code. It's iterative, and I'll go in and I'll test something and see if it works. And if it works, I know then
in the meeting.
Meeting.
Yep.
And then I know that the next meeting I go into, I'm going to focus on what worked in that previous meeting. And then I can build on that and I'll see, okay, that didn't work. So when I go to the next investor meeting, I'm going to focus on what did work. And what happens is by having enough of these investor meetings, by the final investor meeting, I've got it so kind of down packed that I know exactly the journey that I'm going on and how I'm positioning it and what I'm focusing on and the features that I'm focusing on, because I know that that is what got the best reception when speaking to investors.
I love this. So this is very important. So, for people listening to these things, and this doesn't matter whether you're raising money, whether you're just trying to prosecute your idea to see whether people warm to it or there's a market for it. I'm a big proponent of what you do. So I quite like having lots of meetings with lots of people, and people go, oh, that was might be a waste of time, or is that a punishment? Why am I going to do this meeting? I've got a lot of other things I should be prioritizing. Yes, but in the beginning, at least, the more people you talk to, the more people you present to, the more refined your whole proposition becomes.
100%.
And you need, some people, by the way, don't operate this way. Some people just go and they just go mental and they just put it straight out there and, they hook a big fish.
Yeah.
I think that might be more luck.
100%.
You know, and but they're those same people who just do that are the first people to prosecute, say, don't waste your time, all this sort of shit. Don't talk to VCs. Don't talk to this organization. Don't do it. But what you should do is just go for the big, find yourself a billionaire who can invest in you. Yeah, but billionaires aren't dumb, and they, generally speaking, do like you to start from the beginning and build it up for them. They're very rare. Do you actually hook them? What's your experience with this stuff? Because you've seen all these billionaires. You've seen a whole lot.
My experience is, first of all, relationship is key. I don't think there's a single investor that we've brought on board that in the first meeting I landed them. Not a single one. Most of them were multiple meetings in terms of building that relationship and that mutual trust to basically say, this is what I say that we're going to do, and I can actually show you that we actually did what I said we were going to do. And the other thing is I was always very focused on putting the right people around me. It wasn't just taking money for the sake of taking money. It's actually identifying what value someone can bring with their money.
As an investor, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, value add.
Exactly. So, I mean, for argument's sake, I mean, there have been a lot of people that probably that still do think that Nick is the key investor. And Nick is an investor, but he's one of our minority investors. And one of the big reasons, amongst others, is that if he was our only investor, then I know how time poor he is because there's so many other priorities going on for him. And I would know that I wouldn't get the resourcing that I need and the mentoring that I need from these other investors in order to open the doors and to validate ideas and come to retailer meetings and meet with my team. That is what is important to me. So everyone, I've been very intentional that every single person that hits the cap table has got some value add. It's not just taking money for the sake of taking money. It's actually people paying in order to contribute.
Participation.
Exactly.
As opposed to I'm an investor, I want to return and hassle.
Exactly. One of the VC funds that we brought in this round, I caught up with her for coffee the other day, and she said, I work for you. Let me know what you need. And first of all, I mean, that's what you want in an investor, is someone who's contributed and now is looking at how they can add value. But I turned around to her and I said, and this is my response to her, and this is the response to everyone in my team. I was like, you don't work for me, you work with me. And everyone in my team is the exact same thing. No one works for me, everyone works with me. I've got a different role in the company than anyone else, but I'm no better or more important than any of my engineers or my product manager or my sales team or ops or anyone. And we're all equal contributors towards this, and we all have our own role in this company.
Very interesting. So, Simon, you've gone beyond prototype. You're selling into at this stage. You're selling.
So it's
a license arrangement. Do people license fee?
Yeah.
So you license them. Do you give them number of licenses per shop user license? How's it work?
So we give them unlimited user access. Right. We charge them per shop per month.
Per shop per month. Yeah. So you've gone beyond prototype. You're up and running. Obviously, there's going to be more iterations as you learn.
Always.
And you've got your investor base at this stage set?
Yes.
You've got a runway, capital runway and cash flow. I mean, cash flow is usually not positive until a certain point in time, but you've got the whole thing mapped out.
Yep.
Where do you want to land this in the end, Simon? Like, what do you see? I know it's a big question, but where do you see you being? I mean, do you see you being the Atlassian for engineers or the Canva for designers? Like,
it's a good question. When I go back to the start of my professional career, I was chasing the salary. I was chasing the dollars. And I kind of nipped that in the butt pretty early. And what I realized was that I wanted to chase the knowledge. And what I learned was that if I do things right, then the money will come. And it's the same mentality that I've got here. Yes, I've kind of got this kind of cash flow forecast in terms of where I want to get this and the targets that I want to hit. But I wholeheartedly believe that if we do things right, if we treat retailers right, if we listen to them and we build the right products, that everything else will fall into place. And all I'm focused on is getting a return for every single one of my investors, because that is what's most important to me. They believed in me enough to put their money where their mouth is, and I want to make sure that I repay them But I know, again, that the side effect of that is that it will work out for me as well. But that's not my driving force. My driving force isn't what is my net worth going to be at the end of this. My driving force is actually, what is the net worth of my engineers going to be? What is the net worth of my investors going to be?
So you give it, is your staff all participate in
equity? Everyone in my team's got equity.
And do you give it like on an earn out? So they you know, it's like, you know, vests over a number of years or what sort of stuff?
Exactly. There's a vesting period.
And where do you get those structured information from? Like, do you lawyers or what are you using to set that up?
Yeah, I brought in an external COSEC who helped me with that stuff. And again, it was a very steep learning curve. I got things wrong. And every time I feel like I've understood, I've gone to the top of a learning curve, there's another learning curve that comes to meet me. And that's what I'm learning is part of running a business and part of being an entrepreneur is that there's always something new that I'm going to have to learn and pick up. And I just need to try and navigate it, making as few mistakes as possible because I know I'm going to make mistakes and do things wrong.
Backfill.
Exactly. But hopefully those mistakes that I make aren't going to be so detrimental that they come back to bite me.
Well, it's the same as writing code though because, you know, you can write something looks unbelievable and the next thing you know, it breaks down and, you know, there's some problem and there's a bug and you got to fix that bug. You fix that bug, there's another three bugs. And you know, but being an entrepreneur is the same.
100%. There's a lot of correlations. There's a lot of correlations between being an engineer and running a business. And there's a lot of correlations between running a business and running a sporting club. There's a lot of, it's amazing how many consistencies there are across different industries. And it's just the same approach, but in a different framework.
And finally, Simon Molnar, your school was right next to Centennial Park. Well, it's on the other side of Centennial Park. Are you a Rooster supporter or a South supporter?
Unfortunately, I'm actually a West Tigers supporter.
Oh, my God. Well, that's better than being a South supporter.
Yeah, I know.
But living in these suburbs, that's better than being a South supporter because that is real bad if you're a South supporter.
I got that from my dad, and every week I'm like, I wish I just support it.
You had a few shocker last couple of years. Yeah. But Benji, I think, would be a good coach.
Yeah, I agree. Again, I'm big into my data and kind of like that ML that sits in my head. The thing about, I guess...
ML being machine learning.
Yeah, the thing about machine learning and AI is it's a lot of confirmation bias. So what I used to... I'm a big rugby league supporter, enjoyed my fantasy rugby league, and I used to get really annoyed.
Which one are you playing on now? Are you on the NRL one?
Or? Yeah, it's called The Bench. And I used to get really annoyed that the players that I picked each week weren't scoring. So what I did was I paid someone offshore to scrape years of NRL data for me. And every week I would punch in two fixtures and it would tell me which players were most likely to score in that game. And long and behold, those weeks, those players were likely to score. And what I also used to do was I used to look at reserve grade data and have a look and see which players are excelling in reserve grade to be able to tell me when they make it to first grade, how likely are they to be successful in first grade? And what ended up happening was these guys in reserve grade kept coming to first grade and then playing Origin or playing for Australia. And I started to realize that there's actually something in this data that I'm looking at. So
you start sharing with Benji?
Yeah, that's part of what I was chatting to him about. I'm become quite friendly with a couple kind of current and former players. And again, what I found is that a lot of the way I run my business resonates with them if their clubs were run the same way.
So what do you say about losing James Tedesco then? Don't talk about it. I'm just joking. Yeah. Simon Molnar, I really liked our conversation. I've enjoyed a lot. There's something in this. Good luck to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Really nice to meet
you. Great chat.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.